The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
This is the Agile Uprising Podcast.
Hello and welcome to the next installation of the Agile Uprising Agile Manifesto Author Review. We are very lucky today. We are joined by the Dr. Jeff Sutherland. Jeff, thanks for joining us today.
Glad to be here.
So I'm Ryan Lockard. I'm joined today by my friend Andy Cleff. And we're looking forward to really talking to you about your history, your involvement at the Agile Manifesto event, and what you've been working on since. So for anyone that is very new to Agile and to Scrum that may not have read any of your books, that is also not aware of what you were doing prior to the manifesto, do you mind enlightening them on what your history is professionally leading up to 2001?
Okay, well, it's a long history. I started off as a fighter pilot in the Air Force, 11 right. years. A lot of that is embedded in Scrum. And my last tour at the Air Force was at the Air Force Academy. I was a professor of mathematics, and I wanted to continue my PhD doctoral work at the University of Colorado Medical School. I wound up as a professor of radiology for many years at the medical school, doing advanced research on simulation of the human cell and understanding complex systems. And the way that all works, how do you change a system from one state to the next, is embedded in Scrum. It was about 1983 that a big bang came by the university and hired me away from the medical school to help them with advanced technology. And as soon as I got to the bank, I looked at what they were doing with their projects, and I told the CEO this was like totally broken. All projects were late. They were just getting later. And I said, why don't you give me the worst business unit in the bank? I'll fix it right away. And we implemented a prototype of Scrum. This was 1983.
Hmm. You could repeat that story still today in many places.
Yeah. I went, okay, so for 10 years, I was going, you know, the bank bought another company. I went to that company. I was hired to many companies. I've run engineering in 11 companies. In 1993, we formalized what we know Scrum today at Easel Corporation. In 1995, Easel was acquired by VMark, and I brought Ken Schwaber in to take a look at Scrum. Right. I said, Ken, you know, you're selling project management methodologies to the big eight consultancies, and they don't work. Why don't you come in and take a look at something that really works? He did for 2 weeks, and he agreed, yes, this works. What I'm selling would not work to run my company. So I said, Ken, why don't you sell Scrum? I wanted to get Scrum out into the market. And so Ken agreed. Basically, I was surprised. He agreed to sell off all his project management business and focus totally on Scrum.
Awesome.
And to kick it off, we wrote a paper together, which was presented at the OOPSA conference in 1995. That's known as the first published document on Scrum. During that period, 1993 to 1995, I was communicating on the internet with all these guys who, most of the Agile Manifesto signatories, right. Bob Martin, you know, Kent Beck, they're all hearing about Scrum evolving. Kent Beck is sending me a note saying, hey, I'm inventing a new process, send me everything on Scrum. So Scrum had an influence on extreme programming. In 2001, we all get together, you know, Ken Schwaber and I, Mike Beadle, the first CEO that ran Scrum throughout his companies, four of the founders of Extreme Programming, and a bunch of consultants and authors of books. And we debated and argued for a day on what will we call what we're doing. Mm. And at the end of the day, we called it Agile based on a book on agile manufacturing. 100 companies said they were lean, and then introduced the customer into product creation, and that made them agile. That's where agile comes from.
Nice.
It's interesting that that's where Scrum comes from, because Scrum comes from Professor Takeuchi Nanaka looking at lean product development in places like Toyota.
Right.
So Scrum and Agile come from lean product development in hardware companies. So, you know, what's happening today is we're going back out into the hardware. Over 50% of our business right now is in hardware companies.
That's incredible.
And we're working with the senior management. We come in at the senior management level, and then we drive it throughout the company, not only into software, but rolling it out. You know, everything is becoming software. You know, hardware has so much software component today that, you know, you get the software guys scrumming, and then the hardware guys need to scrum along with them. And now we're talking about, you know, how do we run Toyota with Scrum?
It's come full circle. Fantastic.
Do you mind if we step back to 93 when you first were working with Ken? You said it was, I want to make sure I heard this correct. You said, I'm sure I've read this story, but I don't know that it ever hit me the way you just explained it. Ken was running a project management with the big consulting companies and selling the, I'm assuming, the traditional waterfall project management approach. And then 2 weeks working with you, learning Scrum, he burnt the barn and said, okay, no, that's passe. We're going to start doing this new thing.
That is absolutely true. Now, you have to understand, though, Ken and I had a long history. I hired him when the bank I went to work for bought a company in Cambridge, Massachusetts. And they sent me out there to, you know, manage their investment, and I wound up running engineering. They had this huge waterfall banking project that had gone on for years. And, today at the bank, when I've done some banking consulting, people have said it costs hundreds of millions of dollars to build what we were building today. Yeah. And, I brought Ken in with his project management tooling to figure out, okay, how late is this project going to be and how much more money is it going to cost us? And it turned out to be a couple of years and many tens of millions of dollars more investment. We had to go out to the venture community and get it. So Ken and I had a very close relationship, started building in 1988. So when we got together in 1995, we had a lot of history with us. And I just said, Ken, you know, this stuff really works. You should sell this. And he said, yeah, based on our history, based on the way waterfall doesn't work, yes.
Now, up to that point, it was your personal experience working on the companies you were in with Scrum. And I think you said either you or Mike might have even said it himself. Mike Beadle was also applying it in his companies. Up until that ratification with Jet or with Ken, had it been used in the public domain at all, or was this pretty much the emergence of Scrum to the community?
It had been used in the sense that lean product development has been widely used in lean manufacturing companies.
Right.
Scrum draws a lot of history from that. But for 1983 until 1995, I had been driving this inside my companies.
Okay. So the and banner of Scrum
exposed to the world when I brought Ken in and said, hey, Ken, let's get this out of my company and out into the market because it really works.
That's awesome. I can attest to that. It really works.
Nice. So I want to bring you back to 2001, just before you went out to Salt Lake City, right? So you had mentioned you had been working with Kent Beck and Bob Martin and these guys. Do you remember who reached out and said, you know, guys, we should go hang out for a weekend and talk shop and slow things down?
You know, Bob Martin was the convener and chair of the meeting. There are a number of other people that told me they had a strong influence in creating that meeting, but Bob called us all up, got us all together, and chaired the meeting.
Do you remember what your thoughts and feelings were when you heard or got the invitation, come on out, here's who's
Well, at the time, I had fairly recently joined a startup, PatientKeeper, and so I was pretty buried in launching a new product. But I felt that, you know, the guys that were getting together out there, that it would probably be an important meeting. So I actually, you know, bailed out of my company for a few days to make sure I got to the meeting.
Yeah.
Did the location have any impact on that? Are you an avid skier?
When I was younger, I used to be an avid skier. But I didn't go out to ski. In fact, I didn't ski when I was out there.
Yeah.
But I went out there because of the group that was gathered. I thought it would be an interesting and important conversation, which it turned out to be.
So of the 17, how many of them had you interacted with either just over the web or over the, I think there was some phone coordination that was going on in the early days as well. Versus how many were just complete strangers?
Mike and Ken we had worked together for years. Kent Beck, we had interacted mainly over the web. Barb Martin for many years, again, back 1995 timeframe. Martin Fowler, I had known for many years. He lives right in the area I live in here in Massachusetts. Some of the other people I didn't know as well, but I knew about, Ward Cunningham and Ron Jeffries, people like that, were well known in the software community.
And had you been exposed to, Ari had the DSDM, and at the time, Alistair?
Yeah, I didn't know anything about DSDM. I just met Ari for the first time at the Agile Manifesto meeting. It's interesting that DSDM is very similar to Scrum, except it has too many roles. So it has kind of a little bit of a waterfall flavor baked into it.
I've never actually practiced DSDM, but I think they also favor a little bit longer time increment.
Yeah.
And then what about exposure to the work Alistair was doing with Crystal? Any familiarity there? Or any XP obviously was...
I had never had any exposure to Crystal. And I met Alistair Coburn for the first time there. And, you know, basically Alistair had been out as a consultant, had written a bunch of books, and basically said, hey, Crystal is actually kind of a framework for thinking more than a specific application. And he told me he had deployed it in his consulting work in the companies he worked with, which I think were about six at the time.
Okay.
Whereas the difference between Scrum and XP and DSDM is that they were quite widely deployed across the industry in many different types of environments. And those were the only three frameworks that were represented that were widely deployed. Unless there were some people representing what I would call the evolution of object-oriented programming and object-oriented design there. Yeah. And, you know, feature-driven development and all that I viewed as arising out of the object-oriented world, all great stuff, but not the agile processes, I think, were Scrum, XP, and DSDM. Those were the ones that were represented. Everything else has come later.
So if you don't mind, if we could just mentally imagine going back to the, I believe there was an evening, the evening before the first planned day you all got together. And I think you guys met up in the room itself, if that sounds right or not. But can you just picture in your head walking into that first room when the 16 other guys were there and you all got together? And were there any emotions that struck up in you? Did you know this was going to be did you have any concept of how special this was going to be? And what were your feelings like as you guys started to convene together in that conference room?
Well, my wife was with me. She was the only woman there. None of the other guys brought their spouse. She said she's probably more testosterone in that room than any gathering she's ever been to. And bigger egos. So right. It was that aspect of it. But none of us thought that there would necessarily anything come out of this. In fact, it was not until the second day, mid-morning, we took a break, 9 of the people went out in the ski slope, 8 of us stayed in the room. Martin Farlow went to the whiteboard, and in 15 minutes, we wrote the Agile Manifesto.
Yeah, I've heard that.
It's funny, people have asked me later, do you think we could have ever written that if we had 17 people in the room? And the answer is no. 8 people wrote it. The other 9 guys did not change a word.
Well, let me ask you this, actually, then, because I think a story I've heard more than once is 2 people, and who the 2 people are still a mystery, actually left the group of 8, went out in the hallway, and either had an argument or a conversation, came back in, quickly jotted the points, and then that smaller group of 8 started having a conversation about, then the others rejoined. Does that sound accurate, or is time...
I don't recall anything going on. I mean, there may have been guys running in the car talking to one another, but the 8 standing around the board that I was part of was an ongoing conversation for about 15 minutes with the same players, facilitated by Martin Farlow. He was doing the writing. It all happened very fast. You know, individual interactions went up there in about 2 minutes. Because people said, you know, it's really the people that make great teams.
Right.
And one of the tool guys said, well, what about processes and tools? And basically the attitude was, well, they usually slow you down, but we don't want to ban them. So let's make a value statement. We value individual interaction over processes and tools. That looked like 2 or 3 minutes. And then Ron Jeffrey says, and working software at the end of every iteration. So you get it out into the market, you get the feedback. That's what builds great product. And then somebody said, well, what do we say about documentation? Well, why don't we value working software over comprehensive documentation? The longest discussion was the third one, which I was actually pushing hard for, because I had just come out of being CTO of what is now GE Healthcare, and we had thousands of hospitals that were always fighting over their contracts. And I said, this is a bunch of crap. We need to get customer collaboration, is what it turned out to be, over contract negotiation. And then one of the XP guys said, and responding to change over following a plan, and the break was over.
You were done.
Ward Cunningham come into the, well, the other 9 comes in. Ward Cunningham looks at the board and says, that's awesome. Nobody changed a word.
That's amazing. That's absolutely amazing.
What did you do for the rest of the weekend?
What's that?
What did you do for the rest of the weekend?
Well, we did come up with these other 12 principles that are behind the Agile Manifesto that are up in the Agile Manifesto page. That was mainly the discussion, into the afternoon. I actually had to leave to the end of the day. There may have been some people hanging around a little bit longer.
Yeah.
But there was an agreement that we would do some publication. Martin was going to write a paper along with Jim Highsmith, I think. And a lot of things started getting written out of that meeting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's beautiful. That value pair really unlocked the thinking. Do you recall if there's any fifth set of values or 13th principles that were proposed and didn't make it into the final version? They kind of stayed on the cutting room floor.
There were only 4 values. The 8 of us came up with it in 15 minutes. We didn't have time to talk about anything else. And it was over.
Good enough for now.
And it was one of those moments where, I mean, it was an awesome moment when Ward Cunningham walked back in and everybody looked at that and said, it just appeared. Okay.
That's great. Yeah. So you have a lot of testosterone in the room. You have a lot of what I would assume are alpha personalities going on. Do you, are there any, not arguments, but disagreements or highly debated items that you can remember from any of the 3 days?
Well, I did post up on my website. One of the guys actually took notes from the days. And I think it was John Kern. Mm-hmm. And I put his notes up on my blog at scruminc.com. And that is the best, real recollection where there's actually some data that's available.
Right.
But obviously, you know, with all those strong personalities in the room, there were strong opinions about everything, and forceful arguments about this and that. Most of us have mellowed out over the last 20 years, but
I don't know. So some of you still have an edge to you. I can speak from experience. I've been stung once or twice.
Yeah.
So, I'm sorry, Andy.
Go ahead. Go ahead, Ryan. You got one question?
I really just wanted to point out, I know you mentioned John Kern's notes. He shared them with us after our first interview with the signers, and I believe we're over the hump now. We're kind of coming in on the last few of you guys. And Andy Hunt also shared some notes with us. If you haven't seen those yet, I'll make sure I email them over.
Yeah, if you can send me those, I'd be glad to. You know,
I really
liked Andy and his partner because, and that led me into programming in Ruby, which I still today, if I have to write a program, I do it in Ruby. Okay. So those guys affected me that way.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, the way his notes are written, I think, are pretty compelling because he has the four value statements written in an order different than what I believe they are on the website. And he had 1, 2, 3, 4 written next to it and then scratched some of those out. And the ordering then went like 3, 2, 1, 4 or something. So I have those numbers ordered wrong, but it seems like you guys wrote them and then sorted them after the fact. So it's pretty interesting to look at. It's a nice artifact. So I'll get that to you.
Yeah. Send it along. Was he in the group of eight that were in that room? There's a picture of us, and you can sort it out from the picture who's there.
Who the eight were.
I believe he was, honestly. I believe he was.
In fact, the picture on the manifesto page is the group of eight.
I was going to ask that, honestly. That's good to hear.
Interesting.
So somebody came in and took a picture.
What a great story. So here we are. 15 years later, I wanted to take some time to explore your thoughts on the state of Agile, how the manifesto has lived up to the expectations that you may or may not have had 15 years ago. Has it achieved what you thought it might?
Well, it certainly has had a major impact, and it's been driven by the web, mobile technologies. People need to iterate fast right now. Mm-hmm. And you know, the Agile process enable you to do that iteration. So the companies that are going to survive are going to be Agile companies. And the problem is that there's a lot of people out there. You know, I was in Silicon Valley a year or so ago, and I visited 12 companies, and I was talking to at least 100 developers in every company, and I asked them, how many of you have working software at the end of a sprint? And that's the second value in the Agile Manifesto. And only 20% of the people raise their hands consistently.
Wow.
So, you know, Silicon Valley has thousands and thousands of Scrum teams, and only 20% of them have working software. So 80% of them are Agile in name only. This is the big problem out there. So what we're trying to do is to, at least from the point of view of the Scrum world, our Scrum Inc. and our training is to teach a style of Scrum which actually delivers the results and gets people happy working product at regular iterations, gets people accelerating, improving, and trying to get enough good Scrum out there so that it doesn't just become, you know, it's a bit like object-oriented programming. I spent many years working in object technology. And you'd go in and look at companies, and they'd say, okay, we're doing object-oriented programming. Okay, show me the code. It's all C procedures. I said, there's not an object to be found in this code. They say, well, it compiled in the C compiler. That's what's going on in the Agile today. You know.
So what do you
compile it? Agile compiler, you know.
Yeah, exactly. But
it compiles to the Agile compiler.
What is the main driver in the industry that allows for this Agile and name only?
So it's a mess. That's a big.
What do you think that the main driver is that enables that Agile and name only movement to continue and perpetuate through 80% of the Silicon Valley?
I don't think Silicon Valley is unique in that regard.
Right. Yeah, I'm using that as a subset.
Better. I think it's a little bit better out here in Massachusetts where Ken and I live, because we're out, you know, banging people on their head. But I'd say it's driven by two things. One is, at the developer level, there's a lot of sloppy craftsmanship. So, you know, Bob Martin is running around the world trying to build craftsmanship among the development community.
And
craftsmen actually can deliver. And now, the reason that they're such sloppy craftsmen, you know, I'm arguing more and more, is driven by management pressure. You know, a lot of implementations of so-called agile in name only today, management says, we need to go faster. You guys down in the pit, we're going to give you a running wheel. It's going to call Scrum. You need to run faster. And up in the boardroom, we want all our same waterfall reports and our same hierarchy and our same, you know, executive suite. But you guys down there, run faster. Okay, that's going on in a lot of companies, and that creates this huge mess and gives a bad name to the whole agile movement.
So a follow-up to that then, because obviously we've all either experienced that or heard that, how do you approach that conversation either with the executive level, the leadership level, or the middle management level to redirect that line of thinking? Because it is prevalent. I'm asked for waterfall reports all the time, yet we're said to be running an innovative and agile organization.
Yeah, okay. Well, we start, when our company asks us to help them out, we start with, okay, we want to talk with the executives first. And, you know, I think Professor Carter at Harvard has done a good job in his book Accelerate describing that, you know, agile and waterfall are like two different operating systems.
Right.
And so you need something. I'm starting to call it you need an agile umbrella that's protecting that agile environment. And that has to have senior leadership on it that can change the rules. Okay. Because it's a different software development life cycle to run an agile world. And if the companies will not create what we call an executive action team to be responsible for the agile implementation, who are trained, run as a scrum, drive impediment removal, we won't work with them. It's just a waste of time.
Do you often see, instead of building that agile umbrella, more of a translation layer? Like, oh, they're going to be doing agile and scrum over here, but we still want to stick with traditional reporting. So we'll find a way to turn story points into estimates, and we'll turn.
Well, the translation layers that we're trying to avoid are some of these scaling frameworks like SAFe. Because we're saying in the agile world, it's all agile. The structure, that leadership structure, the executive action team, it's a scrum. In our best companies, for example, Saab Defense, building the Saab Gripen fighter, the senior management team is a scrum. Or Systematica, CMI5 company in Denmark, the senior management team is a scrum. That's ideal if you can make the whole company scrum. But when people are starting out, if you have a multi-billion dollar waterfall company that's profitable, people don't want to change everything at once. So they need to create and we recommend they create a set of teams that really works that they can use as a model to replicate. Because another major dysfunction we're seeing is, okay, let's boot up 300 agile teams. And they have nothing that works. And so you wind up with 300 teams that suck. And it really is hard to fix.
Well, you've got that, Jeff, and you also have the institutional inertia and systems of HR and comp and all that, and finance, that surround any one of those teams.
Right.
How do you begin to dismantle that?
Okay, so this gets at the whole idea of how do you deal with altering the organizational structure. So back in 2006, a venture company, OpenView Venture Partners here in Boston, asked me to start working with them. And so for over a decade now, we've been trying to drive the venture group uses Scrum for everything. Finance, admin, HR, everything. We know how to do this. We try to drive it into our venture company investments as much as possible. across the companies. In many of the large organizations that Scrum Inc. is working with, we're working with the senior management. I remember Autodesk was an interesting example. We met with the senior management of the division that builds the software that builds skyscrapers, a very interesting bunch. And the senior management, we got together for a workshop. They had HR in there. They had the facilities people in there. And the chief executive said, okay, the purpose of this meeting is to figure out how to change everything. Everything's on the table. HR, finance, facilities, space, everything. And we want to make a list of what needs to change to get this company like totally agile. So that's a way a really good senior management team approaches this. They're going to really turn everything upside down and get it into an agile framework. That is not the way most companies approach it. They don't know what agile is. They give it lip service. They want to protect their job. Whatever their old job was, they want to make sure that doesn't go away. And that makes it very difficult to get good performance out of the teams when you have that kind of environment.
So I'm curious. So we've covered Agile and Scrum and software and hardware. And now we're talking about how it applies as a methodology in HR and finance. Are there any other surprising places that you never imagined an Agile mindset would appear, but it has?
Well, you know, as a former fighter pilot, that's the way we, you know, planned getting in and out alive, and it hasn't changed much. So I never knew any better than doing it this way.
Right.
And frankly, you know, when we met with, when Ken Schwaber got involved, his brother worked at DuPont, and he wanted them to meet with the experts in process control at DuPont. They had hired two professors, Obanaki and Ray, to come in and to stop the plants from exploding. And so Ken went down to meet with them, and he described what we were doing, and he said, well, this waterfall process you described, that means you must have very few requirement changes during product development, less than 3 or 4%. And Ken says, oh, no, we have over 50% change. And they started laughing at him. I mean, they were laughing so hard, Ken was embarrassed. And he, you know, he says, you know, why are you guys laughing? They said, because you must have a lot of exploding projects, and you guys are not doing anything to prevent that. You actually think that this is going to work. It's a totally inappropriate process control mechanism. It's what we call a predictive process control mechanism. And if we apply that in a chemical plant for a process that has high variability, the chemical plant blows up. Bhopal, okay? So they said, you guys need to read the book, the chapter on process control. They said, whatever you do, go back and fix that software and get empirical process control in there. They couldn't believe the idiocy of what we've been doing. Some years later, Craig Larman interviews the guy that wrote the waterfall spec for the Department of Defense. He said, I didn't know any better. I didn't know anything about software. I read some books. I talked to some stuff.
I've read that white paper.
Thing. I know it doesn't work. I'm sorry. I apologize. It was a mistake.
applying Taylorism to software is probably a poor one.
The whole thing is a complete mistake. And as soon as I was brought from medical school into that environment, I told the CEO of the bank, you got to fix this immediately. It is totally broken. It will never work.
Yeah.
It only took me like a few days to realize that. I was astonished, just like Obanaki and Ray were. How can these guys be running projects that are always late and everything they do is going to make it later?
Right.
Makes no sense.
So I have a question. We talked a little bit about, you know, the work that you're doing at the executive and the leadership level. Maybe not for you personally, but as an agile community, we're going to continue to see the trend. We're going to have more and more people entering the agile community, entering the practice of agile and Scrum. What at that level, so those emerging and those starting their Agile journey, what hopes or what desires do you have for that next wave? If you could help write the future, what would you like to see them focusing on more? How would you like to see them change their organizations?
Well, you know, my focus is not there right now, okay? Earlier this year, the World Bank came to me and said, we've been tracking the world poverty level for decades, and in 2015, it started dropping below 10%. We think we're going to have a whole different business model for the World Bank. Maybe we should run it with Scrum. So we send a team in there, and it's become clear that the whole thrust now in building a world that's better is building small businesses and building economies. And this kind of culminated last month when a Eisenhower fellow from Kenya came to my product owner class in New York, and he said, I'm CEO of an incubator that starts up clean energy companies in Nairobi. And we are funded by the World Bank. I read your book, and it absolutely has changed the life of the people. It's tripled the investment of the World Bank in my business. And he says, I want you to come back and help me train 10,000 Scrum Masters in Africa. We can change the entire continent.
Powerful.
So frankly, my attention is, I think in the software world in the United States, the market is going to sort things out. You know, the teams that suck will be put out of business, and the ones that are great will win. I'm trying to figure out how I'm going to boot up 10,000 Scrum Masters in Africa right now. Also, next month I'm going to Japan because the guys in Japan have been telling me, you know, there's not enough Scrum in Japan. And you need to start Scrum Inc. in Japan. You need to come over here and work with the Japanese leaders in the corporate economies here. So I'm going back over to Japan to start a Scrum Inc. initiative that's driven by a multi-billion dollar company whose lead owner is Toyota.
I have to point out the beautiful irony of the fact that you're basically doing what Edward Deming did, back
in the... We're bringing it full circle, yeah.
It's incredible. It's awesome.
Yeah, we're bringing it full circle. And I think that this whole thing has evolved way beyond software teams.
Really?
Even way beyond Silicon Valley. I mean, it's gotten out there where it has implications for countries, for governments. I think even in the political realm, unless you have, a bunch of agile guys running your campaigns, both fundraising, voter targeting, your tweeting, that is driving, who's going to get elected these days. I mean, everything is changing because of agility.
There. Andy, did you have any questions?
I'm pondering, and I'm wondering, so let's take this as a thought experiment, Jeffrey, if you will. So 10,000 new Scrum Masters in a, I don't know, a time box of 5 years, 1 year, what's your time frame?
Well, he said, okay, let's take the Scrum Alliance. How long did it take them to get 10,000 Scrum Masters? Well, Scrum Alliance has about 500,000. So I don't know how long it took to get the first 10,000, but probably a few years.
Okay, so within a few years. And is the patterns, the principles, and the values that currently exist as written out in the Manifesto for Agile Software Development, as well as in the Scrum Guide, is that the playbook for these 10,000 in Africa, or is it time for V2.0? Or is there something you would change?
Well, what really changed things for the African company and his people. And he said, none of this is software. He says, I'm talking about 10,000 scrum masters, and maybe 10 of them would be software guys. The other 9,990 will be small business development. But in the book, Scrum, the Art of Doing Twice the Work in Half the Time, which was written for the average business person, just getting people together, you know, getting a Scrum board, getting the team in front of that board, talking every day, having short meetings, having short sprint cycles, the just these basic motions, it really can unleash people if it's done in a creative way. And the Agile values are there, but remember, the values are not an implementation. You know, it's sort of like object technology has inheritance, polymorphism, and message passing. But those don't buy you anything until you write C++ or C sharp or, you know, or Java, right? I mean, values are good, but when the rubber hits the road, you've got to have an implementation that works. And so a really kind of a lightweight Scrum that has the discipline that is represented by the Agile Manifesto values is what can change Africa. It can change anything. So,
Jeff, I have one final question, and I wish I asked it earlier so it wasn't the one that we ended with. But looking back, not just at the Manifesto event, but looking back at what's happened since, are there any regrets? Is there anything that, given a do-over or mulligan, you may have approached differently?
You know, that question was asked at the 10th reunion at the Big Agile conference a few years ago. We had almost all the signatories there, and at the end of a meeting with like 1,500 people in the audience, this question was posed to us, and Ron Jeffrey said we would make only one change in the manifesto. At the bottom of it, we would write, and we really mean it, particularly working software.
That's awesome.
So our regret is there are so many teams out there without working software.
Ship it, right? Ship it.
Yeah. How much value is there in theoretical software?
None whatsoever. Well, what a great chance to talk with you, Doctor. This has been such a pleasure.
I appreciate the opportunity, and it's always good to talk with people who know a lot about this community, because you can just kind of get off on a riff about it, you know.
Yeah. So as we come to a close here, unfortunately, are there any events that are coming in the Scrum Inc. or the Jeff Sutherland world that you'd like to promote?
Yeah, well, my website, scruminc.com, has a list of training, and most of my training in the U.S. is focused in Boston and New York right now, because about half my time is in Europe, mainly in the Netherlands and Germany at the moment, but sometimes moving around. So if people want to get involved with what we're doing, they can go to the website, scruminc.com, look at the training stuff. Look at Scrum Lab, which is, we try to get everything about Scrum that we've collected over the last 20 years up there. It's a good resource for people.
Yeah, and we should make sure that we give a nod to our friends in the Netherlands. It's our third most populated demo. So
absolutely, yeah. The Netherlands, you know, different cultures have different styles. And the Dutch are very much in your face. You know, they will get the impediment on the table. And not only that, you can actually get them to fix the impediments. And this is a challenge for sometimes in the United States.
Great. Well, Jeff, again, we thank you very much. This will be posted to the Agile Uprising website, agileuprising.com. We'll obviously be tweeting it and talking about it at the coalition, coalition.agileuprising.com. So thank you one last time, Jeff. It's been an honor.
Okay, appreciate the opportunity. Have a great Christmas.
You too.